Here we go with part two. We're going to pick up where we left off, talking about the implied warranty of merchantability. Let's talk about the implied warranty of merchantability in personal injury contexts. There is overlap between strict products liability in tort and breach of the implied warranty of merchantability under the UCC. You can use both of them to sue if you're injured by a product, but the doctrines are different and occasionally may reach divergent outcomes. So if you've got a personal injury situation from a product, you want to think about both the implied warranty of merchantability and strict liability in tort and think about them independently. Don't try to interact them. Just work through one and work through the other and see if you can make a claim work under either one. For strict products liability in tort, the question is whether or not the product has a defect. And that may involve inquiring about consumer expectations and cost versus benefits of alternative designs. For breach of the implied warranty of merchantability, the question is whether the good was merchantable, which generally comes down to whether or not it was fit for the ordinary purpose for which it was used. So if you drive off in a car and the wheels come off of the car, that's an unmerchantable car. And they have different requirements, so you want to think of those differently. Let's next talk about the implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose. The implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose arises where the buyer has a particular purpose for the goods, and the seller has reason to know this. And the buyer is relying on the seller to help select suitable goods, and the seller has a reason to know about this reliance. So if you go to the store to buy you go to the store to buy a certain pair of shoes. You say, yeah, I'm planning to run a marathon, and it's the special running shoe store. They say, oh, yeah, I've got the shoes for you. They're these over here. But after 10 miles, they disintegrate under you. Then you'd have a great, great case for implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose. So the implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose, what does it warrant? That the goods are fit for that purpose. I mean, that was pretty easy, what you might expect. And there's two alternatives for a disclaimer: a conspicuous written disclaimer or use of as is with all faults or similar language. Next is express warranties. An express warranty, it doesn't arise by default under the UCC. It's not implied by the transaction. It comes from what the seller is expressing. So it arises when the seller makes an affirmation of fact, promise, or description relating to the goods that become part of the basis for the bargain. Words like warranty and guarantee are not necessary. There's express warranties everywhere. You pick up a can of soda, and it says that it contains zero calories. If it contains a bunch of calories, that's a breach of an express warranty. There's express warranties all around. It doesn't have to have some kind of gold seal on it and say warranty. It's any time there's an affirmation of fact, promise, or description relating to the goods. So an express warranty warrants that the goods will conform to that affirmation of fact, promise, or description. Theoretically, an express warranty cannot be disclaimed. How would that work? Say, I warrant that this soda has zero calories, and I disclaim that. Might have any number of calories. That's ridiculous. So you really can't make an express warranty and disclaim it at the same time. It makes sense to disclaim warranties that arise by implication. You're saying, don't take that implication. I know you think you think that this is going to be merchantable, but I want to dispel that implication. But to make an express warranty and disclaim it at the same time makes no sense. But, because this is a little tricky, disclaimers, the effect of a disclaimer can often be achieved in practice through the use of the parole evidence rule. You go to the car lot. They say, oh, this car runs great. New tires, new shocks. It'll run for 50,000 miles before you need any work on it. You're like, great. And then you sign the dotted line, take the car, pay your money, and the car breaks down as it's driving off the lot. So an express warranty was made. You can't really disclaim it, But if you have a fully integrated contract that says all the terms are in here, then you've achieved, in effect, the disclaiming of an express warranty. What are you going to do in a situation like that? You're going to depend on consumer fraud statutes or a common law fraud action. There's all kinds of federal regulations about selling cars. There's other things that can protect you in that situation. But when the express warranty and the parole evidence rule meet with a fully integrated contract, you can get some pretty unexpected and shocking results for a buyer. Next, warranties, privity and remoteness issues. What about when I want to sue someone for breach of warranty, but I don't have a contract with them? So I want to sue an automobile manufacturer for breach of warranty, but I didn't actually buy the car from the automobile manufacturer. I bought it from a dealership. So how does that work? Can you, if you bought an item from a retailer, can you, who bought it from a wholesaler, who bought it from the manufacturer, can you sue the manufacturer, the wholesaler for breach of warranty? How about if a guest is in your home and they are injured by a product that you buy? Can your guest sue the seller for a breach of the implied warranty of merchantability? And the answer is that it's complicated. And I'm not going to go over it all here, actually, because it's the sales lightning review. And so we're not going to stop to go through it all. But you should understand that you can't assume that you need privity. There are some circumstances under which you can sue, even if you weren't the purchaser of the product from the warrantor, and in some circumstances where you need privity. It's complicated, but don't assume that you need privity and don't assume that you can get by without it. For a concise review, I have a handout. There's a link to it on the page with the audio recording. It's called Warranty Privity Remoteness Issues. It's pretty concise. I'll let you look at that if you want to, and you can work through it. But it's different for express warranties and implied warranties, and it's complicated. But make no assumptions. And this is part of why I say it's just best to think of breach of warranty as its own thing. It's not breach of contract. It's not tort. It's got some features of both and some dissimilarities. So just think of breach of warranty as its own beast. Now, we need to talk about notice. To have a claim for breach of warranty, any of the warranties, under the UCC, you must give notice within a reasonable time after you should have discovered the warranty breach. If you don't, you will be barred from any remedy. This is a huge potential pitfall for warranty claimants, and this is an easy get out of jail free card for defendants. So here's a practical tip. If you have a potential warranty breach, send out notices to everyone you can find in the chain of distribution and send them out as soon as possible. They don't have to be real complicated. Just get something out, start notifying people. Yeah, wheels came off my car. Notify everyone you can and do it quickly to preserve your ability to bring a warranty claim. A lot of, in the sales course, we read a lot of heart-tugging cases about terrible injuries and things where plaintiff was left with no claim because they did not get notice in within a reasonable time. A final note on warranties beyond the UCC. There's more to warranties than just what is in the UCC. In particular, the Federal Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act, which is at 2301 et sec of Title 15 of the United States Code, has a huge effect on consumer warranties. The Magnuson-Moss Act is the explanation for much of what you see in the little slips of paper that come with your products, such as 90-day limited warranty. Why does everything say that? It's because of the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act. I'm not going to get into that, but if you want a full picture of warranties, you should look at the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act. There are also various state consumer protection statutes that can be an important source of warranty law as well. A lot of things that you can weasel out of under the UCC as a seller, you can't get away with that under Magnuson-Moss, under state consumer protection statutes. So for a full picture, explore that. So that's it for warranties. Next, let's move on to excuse and avoidance. We have a deal. We made a deal. We figured out what the terms of the deal. Now I want to get out of the deal. Excuse and avoidance. First, unconscionability. Unconscionability. Generally, people are stuck with bad bargains. The UCC wants deals to happen. It wants commerce to happen. It wants freedom of contract. What's got to give? And a lot of that is some people are going to get screwed. And the UCC would rather some of that happen than not have as many deals and as much freedom of contract as it could have. Unconscionability is meant to be rare as a defense. If you're going to succeed on an unconscionability claim, generally, and differs by court, but generally courts want you to prove both procedural unconscionability and substantive unconscionability. What does that mean? Procedural unconscionability means there was some unfairness or oppression in the making of the deal. There was some absence of meaningful choice. Someone was kind of bamboozled or put at a disadvantage. There might have been a language barrier. High-pressure salesperson barging in on someone when they couldn't make sense of things. Something in the making of the deal that made it really unfair. And there has to be substantive unconscionability. The terms of the deal are oppressive and unreasonably harsh. If you have both procedural and substantive unconscionability, what can a court do about it? Well, a court can not enforce the contract at all and completely let you out of the deal. Or the court can say, well, you're right, this is totally unfair procedurally and substantively, but we want to keep the deal, so I'll just excise the unconscionable portion. Or the court can do even less. The court can limit the effect of the unconscionable portion. That's unconscionability. Some other means of excuse and avoidance. This is the lightning review, so we're not going to get into these, but I want to tell you that they exist. Common law fraud action is still there. And the common law fraud doctrine for avoiding a contract. The statute of frauds, which we already talked about under formation, is a way to get out of a contract. The UCC has two provisions dealing with commercial impracticability. 2615 is the general commercial impracticability provision. This applies where there's some unforeseen contingency that makes it impractical for the seller to perform, such as a natural disaster. So last month you contracted to buy a bunch of plywood, then to be delivered a month from then. In the interim, a hurricane was cooked up in the Gulf of Mexico and everyone bought all the plywood for several states around. You'd say, oh, commercial impracticability. Now, if you buy the plywood when the hurricane's on its way and everyone's talking about it on the TV and then the seller says, oh, there's a hurricane, so I can't get to the plywood. Well, at that point, it's not an unforeseen contingency, so you wouldn't be able to get out of it. That's the general commercial impracticability provision. Then there's also a separate special, what I call a special commercial impracticability provision at 2613. If the particular goods that are identified in the contract are destroyed before risk of loss is passed to the buyer. So you have a contract to buy a particular car, and that car gets hail damage or completely destroyed before the time for you to pick it up. That's the special commercial impracticability provision. And that gives the buyer of taking the goods with a reduction for price to account for the damage, or allows the buyer the option of getting out of the contract altogether. Then, final means of excuse or avoidance to let you know that it exists, frustration of purpose. So this is where the purpose for which the goods were being bought has ceased to be. So if you were purchasing a limousine to use for a big parade, and then the parade is canceled, I guess. But good luck. Frustration of purpose is pretty hard to win, and it's meant to be rare, kind of like unconscionability. If you're going to make frustration of purpose work, it really helps if the seller is put in no worse position than they were before the contract. So if you agree to buy something, then your purpose is frustrated, and you call them up and you say, no, I'm not going to buy it, and they haven't pulled in any new inventory because of that, or they haven't passed up any opportunities to sell because of that, then that's a situation where you might be able to win frustration of purpose. That's it for excuse and avoidance. Let's move on to our next big topic area, risk of loss. And I'm only going to tell you a little bit about this because it's very complicated. So, risk of loss, some main principles. If the contract provides for who holds the risk of loss, then the contract controls. So if you agree to buy a car to pick it up on Thursday, and in the contract you agree that if the car is destroyed between now and Thursday, that you will bear the burden of the risk of loss, then the contract controls. That's easy. Otherwise, if the contract's silent on it, then if the loss is caused by negligence, then the negligent party has to absorb the loss. So if you're going to buy a car, the delivery date's a week from now, in the meantime, the seller got intoxicated and drove 125 miles an hour and wrapped it around a concrete pylon, then yeah, they're going to absorb the loss because they were negligent. This will deal with most of the things in the real world in terms of risk of loss, and that rule is easy to employ. Now, if the loss is without fault, so something's destroyed in shipment by an earthquake or a meteorite or a collision with some third-party drunk driver, then the UCC has all these default rules for risk of loss. They are complex. I can tell you as a broad principle, they are mostly designed based on which party is likely to have insurance. It's kind of how they did that when designing these UCC default rules. As a general matter, risk of loss tends to pass with title and possession, which sort of makes sense. That's the extent to which I'm going to talk about it here in the lightning review. But there's some broad principles. Now, let me make you aware of one pitfall. This came to me as a question one time. If the goods cause damage to something or someone, like you contract to buy a large wind turbine, and while it's coming down the interstate, it comes off of the truck bed and destroys someone's house, the UCC has nothing to do with that. That's just a torts question. Okay, it doesn't matter that a good was involved. That's just a torts question. So, we're risk of loss. We're talking about the good itself is destroyed, not the good comes off of a truck and destroys something else. Not a UCC question if that happens. Let's move on to our next big area. That's it for risk of loss. Let's talk about performance and breach. Performance and breach. First up, anticipatory repudiation. Anticipatory repudiation. If one party repudiates the contract, the other party can suspend its performance and cancel the contract. You have a contract to buy a car, and the other party says, you know what? I'm not going to deliver that car that I contracted to deliver to you. Well, at that point, you can suspend your performance and you can cancel the check and not go through with the contract. That's pretty easy. Next, if one party has reasonable grounds for insecurity, then that party can demand adequate assurances. So we had a contract that you were going to deliver a bunch of plywood to my house, and I went to your store, you were going to deliver that on Saturday, and I went to your store on Thursday, and there was no plywood in the store, and I talked to some people there, they're like, yeah, we can't find plywood anywhere. It's a crisis. That's reasonable grounds for me to be insecure that you're going to be able to make this plywood delivery on Saturday. So in a case where one party has reasonable grounds for insecurity, that party could demand adequate assurances. They demand adequate assurances. If the demanding party at that point They are then permitted to suspend performance until adequate assurances are provided. I can suspend my payments until I get adequate assurances. If adequate assurances are not provided within a reasonable time, 30 days maximum, then the party failing to provide those assurances is deemed to have repudiated the contract. And in that case, the aggrieved party is now permitted to cancel the contract. Time to talk about a pitfall with anticipatory repudiation. You should be aware of the danger of one party claiming the other party repudiated the contract and then canceling the contract on that basis. Where party A cancels a contract on the basis of a claimed repudiation by party B, and that supposed repudiation is later judged by a court to not have been a true repudiation, then party A is held to have repudiated the contract and therefore breached it. So if I'm going to say you repudiated the contract, therefore I'm not going to perform, I can't be wrong. Because if I make a mistake and think you repudiated, and it turns out you didn't, then I'm the one who breached. Which is why the demand for adequate assurances under the UCC is there. You don't have to be all in. You could say, oh, I think maybe you're repudiating and won't be able to deliver, so I'm going to demand adequate assurances. Safer course. Then, if you don't get the adequate assurances, then you're on sure footing for canceling your performance under the contract. Otherwise, you claim that the other party repudiated and you don't perform, you're taking a risk that the judge is going to see it the same way you do. Now, let's talk about what can a buyer do when there are non-conforming goods. You ordered 1,000 8-foot lengths of 2x4s, pine, and you got a bunch of worm-eaten 2x2s made out of some... Pine's not a very good wood, so I don't know it would be worse than pine, but whatever. Some substandard wood. Okay, so you got non-conforming goods. Hey, this isn't what I ordered. What a buyer can do for non-conforming goods, I want you to think about it chronologically, is proceeding in three stages. There's kind of three points where you can jump off the train. So it starts out easy for the buyer, and then it gets, as we progress through time, harder for the buyer to do anything. So ordered chronologically, the buyer can reject. If they don't reject, then later they might be able to revoke. If they don't revoke, later they might be able to sue for breach of warranty. So first, reject. Next, revoke. Finally, sue for breach of warranty. But note that things are different for installment contracts. If there's multiple deliveries, installment contracts have their own rules, and there's no perfect tender rule for installment contracts. So if you've got an installment contract, then go look it up. All right. Let's talk about this. Non-installment contracts, the three stages, chance to reject, chance to revoke, chance to sue for breach of warranty. So first, reject. Within a reasonable time, and by giving notice, you can reject goods because they aren't perfect. If you order goods and there's something slightly off about it, you can reject it, even if it'd be reasonable for you to keep it. Like you ordered a car that's got all these features, and one of them was that the wheels had to have 8 little spokes instead of 7. And you're like, well, no, that's not quite what I ordered. Like, no one's going to notice. Maybe this is the spare wheel that no one even sees. And it's like, let's say it's even a cheap part. It's like a $70 part of a $50,000 car, but it's not exactly what you ordered. Like, I reject the whole car. Now I'm not taking it. You can do that. That's what's called the perfect tender rule. Tender's got to be perfect, or you could just reject it. It's very powerful for the buyer. Okay. A seller has a right to cure under two circumstances. One, if there's still time under the contract to make a conforming delivery. Like I said, I was going to get you that car on Saturday. I delivered the non-conforming car on Friday. I still have a day to get you the conforming car. Or if the seller had some reason to believe that a non-conforming good would be acceptable. Like, well, you said last night you didn't really care about the spare tire. Then you'd have a right to cure. Otherwise, you can reject just because the goods aren't exactly perfectly what you ordered. That's the perfect tender rule. Okay, if the buyer doesn't reject, and that's something you got to do right away when you get the goods. If you don't reject the goods, you let them sit there, then the buyer has accepted the goods. Once you've accepted the goods, then the buyer can't reject, and the buyer will have to pay up. But at that point, maybe the buyer can revoke. That's our next stage. So maybe the buyer can revoke, but it's a little bit harder to revoke than reject. So let's look at revoke. So within a reasonable time and with notice, you can revoke acceptance because, number one, the non-conformance substantially impairs the value of the contract. So it's got to be a big non-performance. Not because the spare tire wasn't exactly what I ordered, but something's really off that now the value of the contract has been substantially impaired. So it's got to be a big thing, not a mere imperfection. So number one, the non-conformance substantially impairs the value of the contract. And number two, one of three things. So you got to have substantially impair the value of the contract and one of these three things. Either the buyer thought the seller would cure. That's why I waited. That's why I didn't reject. I thought you were going to cure. So the buyer thought the seller would cure. Or the seller gave assurances that strung the buyer out. So the seller said, oh, yeah, I can fix the spare tire. Yeah, I can fix that part. Just hold your horses on that. Don't rush me. So if the buyer's been strung out, I shouldn't use the spare tire example because that wouldn't substantially impair the value of the contract. So it's got to be substantial impairment of the contract, and either the buyer thought the seller would cure, or the seller gave assurances that strung the buyer out, or there was some reason the buyer couldn't discover the non-conformance before accepting. So you accept your new car, and you think that it's a flex fuel vehicle that runs on ethanol, but you're down in Texas where they only have gasoline. And it's not until you drive up to somewhere in the upper Midwest that you get to an ethanol fueling station, you put it in, and the car stops working. You're like, now I've discovered it doesn't work on ethanol. Okay, so that'd be a reason I couldn't discover the non-conformance before accepting. All right, once time has passed for revocation, then all the buyer can do, maybe, is sue for breach of warranty. So let's look at breach of warranty. You can sue for breach of warranty if all the requirements of a warranty action are met. We already talked about warranties. But if a breach of warranty action won't work, then you're out of luck. So you ordered something, it came, it wasn't exactly what you ordered, but you let it sit there, and you knew about it, and you passed your time to reject, and you didn't have grounds for revoking, and the warranties were all disclaimed. You're out of luck. So in a sense, it's kind of like, it works like the statute of limitations, but sort of right away. And the thing is, the UCC figures, once you ordered something, you got the goods, you saw they weren't what you ordered, you either got to reject that or it is what it is. All right, if you'd like all that stuff I talked about, reject, revoke, super breach of warranty, on one page, there's a handout I have online for that. Now, finally, let's talk about our next big subject, remedies. What can you get when you sue? Remedies. Some things in general, or the biggest thing in general with remedies, this will answer 99% of your remedies questions. The UCC wants you, the aggrieved party, to get the benefit of the bargain. That's what the remedies are all about. They're all about the benefit of the bargain, aka protecting the expectation interest. All the remedies, all this stuff, is all based around benefit of the bargain. So have some hope. I'm going to throw some math equations at you with some symbols and stuff. But if you just remember benefit of the bargain, you can derive all these little equations. You can just figure it out on the back of an envelope because it's really all just different ways of thinking, how can we get the aggrieved party the benefit of the bargain? So if you're looking at the slides, I have a bunch of abbreviations for these things, and I'm sticking those in the slide for you to refer to. Okay, so some general points about remedies. Like other things in the UCC, the parties can change remedies by contract, but only to a point. There must be a remedy that does not fail of its essential purpose. If you have a contract for a sale of goods, the other party's got a lot of bargaining power, and it says in there, buyer, you're the buyer. It says, buyer's remedy is limited to an apology and a 50-cent coupon. That fails of its essential purpose. That's essentially no remedy at all. That makes the whole thing illusory, and the UCC will not tolerate that. So you got to have some meaningful remedy. Also, a limit that the UCC puts around this is that sellers cannot get consequential damages. But buyers can, and in contracts for the sale of goods, sellers often try to exclude consequential damages by contract. A lot of times when you buy things, there's a bunch of fine print. One of the things that's in there is it says, no consequential damages, because then sky's the limit. So you contract to buy a pair of shoes for me, and I don't deliver them on time. You say, oh, now I didn't have the shoes. I couldn't win the marathon. I would have gotten $100,000. It's pretty speculative, but maybe there's a situation which it's not speculative. Sellers don't want that, so they will try to modify that and get rid of consequential damages by contract. But sellers can't get consequential damages, really, even if they say, I'm entitled to consequential damages, because sellers, what do sellers get? Sellers get money. What's the consequence of not having money? The UCC assumes you can go to the bank. So if you don't have enough money, you're having a cash flow problem, then we have finance, we have capital markets that you'd be able to fix that. So the UCC does not like the idea of sellers suing because they didn't get money on time. You want money, go to court, get the money. If you want bridge financing, go to the bank. But if you needed a certain object, that's what sales of goods is all about. I money's not good enough. I need a car or I need a windmill. Then the UCC says, oh, well, you need stuff. And if you don't have the stuff, then consequences might flow from that. That's why the UCC says, all right, we'll allow consequential damages for buyers, but not sellers. Okay. So remember, benefit of the bargain. That's going to take you through different measures of remedies. And let's go through some measures of remedies now. And remember this, that the various measures of remedies are not necessarily exclusive. You can pursue more than one at a time as long as you don't double recover and get a windfall. Okay. So let's look at seller's remedies first. First, most normal kind of seller's remedy is action for the price. So you agreed to buy a car from me for $10,000. I want my $10,000. Okay, so action for the price, the damages are the contract price. And then, of course, the seller gets to keep the goods. I can't say, well, you agreed to give me $10,000 for the car, so I want the $10,000 and I'm going to keep the car. Action for the price means the buyer keeps the goods and the seller gets the price. But this is a disfavored remedy because it's specific performance and the law doesn't like specific performance. If you don't want to hold to your contract, the law doesn't like to make you go through with the contract. The law just wants you to get the benefit of the bargain, which means money to make you whole, to make you good, to bring you up to where your expectation would have been. So the law doesn't like that, forcing the buyer to take the goods and pay the price. But it can be used under some circumstances. So that's the first one, action for the price. Next one is contract price, market price differential. The formula for this is contract price minus the market price plus incidental damages minus expenses saved. So if I contracted to buy 700 barrels of oil at $50 a barrel and you didn't go, I'm sorry, I'm the seller, I contracted to sell to you, say, 700 barrels of oil at $100 a barrel, and then you didn't follow through on the contract, and it turns out the market price for oil is $50 a barrel, then I'll take $100 a barrel minus $50 a barrel. So I'll get $50 a barrel times 700 plus incidental damages and minus expenses saved. And that'll be my measure of damages. Why contract price versus market price? Doesn't that leave the seller better off? Yeah, because they were supposed to get the benefit of the bargain. If the seller was so smart they could sell someone a barrel of oil at $100 when it's going for $50, they're supposed to get the benefit of the bargain. That's the idea behind contract price, market price, differential damages. Okay, next, resale and resale damages. So if you were supposed to pick up the car for me, you didn't do that, you didn't pay me for it, I can sell it to someone else. And then the measure of damages is the contract price minus the resale price plus incidental damages minus expenses saved. So I had a fishing hut, ice fishing hut. I was going to sell it to you for $5,000. You breached. I resold it. Best I could do was selling it to someone for $2,000. Get the contract price $5,000. Minus the resale price, $2,000, I get $3,000, plus incidental damages, minus expenses saved. Usually you have to give proper notice, and that's resale and resale damages. Now, you should note that resale damages don't give the benefit of the bargain to a lost volume seller. What's a lost volume seller? Let's say I agree to buy an ice fishing hut, not from you, but from the big ice fishing hut dealer, big store that's got a big inventory of ice fishing huts. They've got 20 on the lot at any given time. If they don't sell an ice fishing hut to you, are they going to resell that ice fishing hut to someone else? If someone else comes on the lot to buy that, that's just an additional sale they would have had. They'll just get more ice fishing huts in from the manufacturer. They'll get in as many as they can sell. If I go into a Target or Walmart and I change my mind and don't buy something, that's a lost sale for them. They're not going to make that up by selling those goods to someone else because they'll sell those goods to as many people who come in. Say I go to a car dealer. I was going to purchase a new pickup truck and then I breach. That's a lost sale. They can't make that up by selling that pickup truck to someone else because if they sell all the pickup trucks on the lot, they'll just get more from the manufacturer. So retailers who can keep replenishing their inventory aren't made whole by resale because then they're just cannibalizing an extra sale that they were going to get anyway from the next customer who comes in the door. So for lost volume sellers, resale damages don't really work. So there's lost profits damages. So lost profits damages are the contract price minus the costs plus incidental damages. So if I don't perform on my contract to buy a new pickup truck from the dealer, the car dealer, then they can get a measure of damages based on, well, the retail price, the contract price was $40,000. I pay $25,000 wholesale to the manufacturer, so I got to get the $15,000 to be up to where I would have been if you'd performed on your contract to get to the benefit of the bargain. Now let's talk about buyer's remedies. Buyer's remedies. So the seller breaches, the buyer is aggrieved. First thing a buyer can do is cover. They can go out and buy something from someone else. So I was supposed to get a pickup truck. You didn't deliver. I had a contract to buy a pickup truck from you for $40,000. You didn't deliver. Now I'm in a rush. I need a pickup truck. I found another one from another dealer, but they charged me $50,000. So I go out and cover by getting goods from another seller. So the measure of cover damages is the cost of cover, $50,000 in my example, minus the contract price, $40,000. Plus incidental damages, plus consequential damages, minus expenses saved. So I got to go out and buy the same item, more expensive, I get the difference. That's cover damages. They are available where goods were not delivered or they were rejected rightfully, as long as the buyer was acting in good faith without delaying unreasonably. Next measure of buyer's damages is contract price, market price differential. That works for sellers and also works for buyers. So that's the market price minus the contract price plus incidental damages plus consequential damages minus expenses saved. This works for non-delivery or repudiation. So you were going to sell me 1,000 barrels of oil at $50 a barrel, and you breach. I just look up, what was the market price on that day you breached? If it was $100 a barrel in oil, we'll just do it on paper. I don't have to go out and actually buy more oil. I can do without it. I can just go by the market price and the contract price. So it's the market price minus the contract price, plus incidental damages, plus consequential damages, minus expenses saved. And note that these can be available even when they exceed actual losses. You can get some pretty big damages judgments here. Let's say it's that oil contract. Contract was $50 a barrel. The market price was $100 a barrel. You were able to cover it $55 a barrel. You can use market price damages and get $50 a barrel in damages. Be pretty nice. Then finally, specific performance. So specific performance is an unfavored remedy for buyers as it is for sellers. You have to show that damages are inadequate. And that might be pretty easy to do where the goods are unique. So if you contracted to buy an antique book, there's only one copy of it around. Now you're not going to get the book. That's a situation where you could get specific performance and force the seller to give you the book, even though they changed their mind. If it's a Ford F-150 pickup truck, well, you could just get one from another dealer. The court won't want to do specific performance there. But if it's an antique, something that's unique, one of a kind, that might be a good case for specific performance. Finally, last of the buyer's remedies is cost of defect, breach of warranty damages. So this is for accepted goods where you haven't revoked acceptance. There's a breach of warranty. The measure of breach of warranty damages is the value of conforming goods minus the value of the non-conforming goods plus incidental damages plus consequential damages. So you bought a car and the wheels fell off the car while you were driving on a winding mountain road. What is a car worth that has wheels that work well? Say it's $25,000. What is a car worth that has wheels that fall off of it? Maybe it's worth $500 for scrap value. So we'll subtract that. Then I'll get incidental damages. I'll get consequential damages for my medical expenses and lost wages because I couldn't get to work. That's your breach of warranty damages for the cost of the defect. So that's the seller's remedies and the buyer's remedies. Finally, last thing to talk about with remedies is to talk about liquidated damages. So what if a contract says, we agree that the damages in case of a breach are going to be $5 million, liquidated damages. We're just going to name that number up front. It's called liquidated damages. To be upheld for a court to enforce liquidated damages, then those liquidated damages must be reasonable. And they must be reasonable in light of the anticipated or actual harm caused by the breach. There must be difficulties in proof of the loss. And there must be inconvenience or non-feasibility of otherwise obtaining an adequate remedy. So for liquidated damages, the court's got to say, yeah, it'd be really hard to figure out damages. And it would be hard to prove them, and it would be inconvenient to obtain an otherwise adequate remedy, and they're reasonable from the point of view of the time of contracting, even if they turn out to be unreasonable in hindsight. So that's liquidated damages. If the liquidated damages are unreasonably large, then they're void as a penalty. You're not allowed to have a penalty for a contract. Well, I want to make sure this contract's performed. I want to make sure that I get my Ford F-150 pickup truck on Saturday. So if it's not here, $5 million in liquidated damages, that should light a fire under them and make sure the pickup truck, that's just a penalty to try to bully someone into performance, and that will be void. You have to prove that the liquidated damages are reasonable, kind of real. Can't just be a penalty. Note that the reasonability of liquidated damages are generally measured from the point of view of making the contract, not hindsight. So even if they turn out to be unreasonably large in hindsight, so long as they were reasonable from the point of view of when the parties were making the contract, they'll be upheld. That's it for remedies. So let's wrap this up. Some big things to remember. The UCC wants deals to happen. As you go through all these little detailed rules, they're not arbitrary. A big guiding principle in there is that the UCC wants deals to happen, and the rules are designed to help them happen. And seeing that principle behind the rules helps you understand them and remember them. The UCC cares about freedom of contract. The UCC wants to let you set the own terms for your deal, but they also want deals to happen, so they'll provide a lot of default rules in case you don't want to spell them all out. The UCC is a statute. So, next big thing, we look to the statutory language for answers. If we want to know what the rule is, we look to the statute instead of saying, well, logically, or I think public policy-wise, we just look to the text of the statute. Next big thing to remember, UCC thinks merchants are special. So a lot of times when we have these detailed rules that depart a little bit from seeming common sense, it's because the UCC is saying, well, merchants got their big girl, big boy pants on. They can handle themselves with some of these rules that let them extend themselves and expose themselves to a little bit more risk than we'd tolerate for others. And then finally, last big thing to remember is the UCC wants you to get the benefit of the bargain. That helps you understand a lot of the warranties and helps you understand a lot of the remedies. Implied warranty of merchantability. Well, if I buy a car, it ought to be able to drive. That's the benefit of the bargain. If you tell me all the warranties are excluded, it's as is, it might not work, then I'm getting the benefit of the bargain because I've been warned. All the remedies equations work by benefit of the bargain. That's it. That's your sales lightning review. Thank you for coming along on the journey. Applause is great. It's always a great way to end an audio recording. Thanks, you guys.